Welcome back. This is Robert Tomlinson, your host for the Tuesday afternoon show. It's almost 5:30. I am now really, really happy to have Rodney Greenblatt in the studio. Welcome, Rodney.
Hello.
I was sort of mulling over how in the world am I going to introduce you? You have so many talents. There's so many things that you do. So I came up with just artist, author, inventor, poet, musician, entrepreneur, and of course, parent.
Yes. That's pretty good.
Is that right?
That covers most of it.
All right. So you were born in Daly City, California.
Many years ago.
And then you moved to Maryland.
That's right.
Now, you told me a story that really intrigued me. So
yes.
You're in your family house in Maryland.
Yes.
And your folks actually, you had a studio space.
Oh, right.
I mean, your parents thought of you and you thought of yourself early on as an artist.
Yes. Yes.
I think you take this so casual. I think it's so unusual. Yeah. So how old were you? Tell us about that.
Somehow my mother identified me as an artist when I was 3 years old.
Really?
There's a photo on my website of me standing and painting a picture on the refrigerator door, wearing an apron and a beret, I think.
Every artist needs one, right?
1963, when I was 3 years old. And I just have kept going since then.
And so you never not thought of yourself as an artist, right?
That's true.
Wow. Did that provide you with a kind of security, you think? It's so different.
Well, it made me very aware of what an artist is and what an artist should do and what an artist shouldn't do. And I think during my lifetime, I've explored every avenue of what being an artist might be.
That's such a great lead. So what is an artist to you? What, from your point of view, can you describe that?
Well, I think it's not really necessary to call yourself an artist, but it is a word, and it's a word that people like to hear to recognize that you're some kind of a creative person involved with some kind of creative endeavor, basically. Mm-hmm. But I've done so many things. I've been an illustrator, and I've also been a painter and a sculptor. Those things seem very different to me, they're all being an artist.
They're all connected.
Yes.
Okay, so you're in Maryland. You've got your own studio. And do I remember the story right? You had a workspace, and then you took over the living room? Is that right?
Where did they put me at first? I had my bedroom, but of course that was too small. Then I took over the, we had like a finished attic. It was a suburban house in Bethesda, Maryland.
Okay.
Then I took over the attic, so I had my room in the attic. In the summer...
There's a workspace.
Yeah, they were both my... I was using them both as my workspace.
Okay, good.
And then also there was a porch in the backyard, like with glass louvers. They used to do it in the old suburban houses.
Right.
And then I used that in the summertime.
You were unstoppable.
And I've been doing that ever since, converting spaces for my own use.
And do you have siblings?
Yes, I have one brother who lives in California.
Older or younger?
Younger.
And how did he sort of take all this in? Was like, oh yeah, that's my older brother. That's what he does. I mean, is he an artist? I should ask that.
No, he's not an artist, but he's a very creative person. He's a contractor. Very different life decisions than myself. But I always kind of feel sorry for him because he was always sort of in my shadow. And
You had all three rooms.
And I was taking over the house, doing all this stuff, getting all this attention.
Right.
And he didn't. Ugh. And it's kind of sad. So I don't think he's listening. He might be. But sorry about that, Stan.
Yeah. Well, here's a shout out to Stan. We're with you, buddy.
But he's a fantastic person. And I'm sorry that he lives so far away. But he was here in Catskill last spring to help me when I started working on my house. And he was really excited about the project.
That's cool. Okay, so you from Maryland, you go to the New York School of the Visual Arts, 1978?
Yes.
That's where you met your wife, Dina?
That's right.
You established a kind of a peer group of artists. It was a very special time to be in New York.
It was.
Want to talk about that?
It was very, very exciting.
Well, you became well known as sort of this group of East Village artists. You were in the pack, right?
Well, during art school, that was a little later, but during art school in the early 80s, I was very lucky to be in art school with some very amazing young artists. One of them, who a lot of people know, is Keith Haring, was at the School of Visual Arts at that time. And he was just turning around the whole notion of what being an art student versus being an artist was. totally redefining what you can do as a young artist.
Can you tell us about that specifically? What do you mean? We would say his things are kind of graphically oriented, but what do you mean by that when you say he turned things around?
Well, I think that art students often think, I will work at a job when I get out of art school, and maybe I'll find a gallery. I don't know what possibilities there really are. It's really kind of a... there's a lot of questions about what you do when you graduate from art school.
Right.
But here was a kid who was not thinking about that at all. He wanted to be a professional artist showing galleries now, basically. It was in the 80s. And he did. If he couldn't be in a gallery, he just started a gallery. The shows that he had at the school were top-notch, experimental art that just like blew everyone away.
Joe, it must have been kind of magnetic in some way.
It was very inspiring. And I think I owe Keith Haring a lot, because maybe not style-wise, but just the energy and also being able to believe in yourself that you could actually do that as a young person was very exciting.
Were there any other artists in that particular peer group at that time that we would know from?
Well, you might know Kenny Scharf.
Oh, sure.
He was friends with Keith. I'm not sure if he ever attended the School of Visual Arts, but Jean-Michel Basquiat was kind of hanging around and doing graffiti in the halls. But Jean-Michel's graffiti was like amazing, fantastic.
Right.
And it was an inspiration.
Well, that's the thing. So was Jean-Michel the inspiration to actually do work out in the subways? Or did Keith Haring pioneer that? Or who was first, or do we know?
I really don't know.
But it happened kind of at the same time.
I think so.
Yeah.
Keith and his friends were very busy.
So they were very interested in sort of breaking down the barriers of what a gallery could be, bringing art out to the public.
Yeah.
And you also were like that, yes?
Well, as soon as I got out of art school, I was asked to be in a gallery that was opening in the East Village. It just opened maybe a year before, called the Gracie Mansion Gallery.
Right.
It was full of amazing, cool young artists. And
as was she.
She was an artist.
She was something, yeah.
And she was making her mark as a gallery person in the East Village. All these small galleries were open, and I was very lucky to be a part of it.
Did you find some economic support at that time?
I certainly did. I sold most of the work that I made.
Really?
At the time. It was so exciting to be a kid. I was 23 years old when I had my first show in the East Village, and I started selling my work right away. I was in the Whitney Biennial in 1985.
My goodness.
I was 25 years old.
Wow.
It was amazing.
I'll bet that was amazing.
Really.
So let's pause. So that was 1985.
Yeah.
Or 2017.
Yeah.
When you look back on that, I mean, do you remember it in a way, or is it faded? Do you go, oh, that was a real important turning point, I'm grateful for that, but it really has nothing to do with who I am now. What is that like for you?
Good question. I think it's a bit of a fog. I mean, I really was a kid. I wasn't that aware of all the possibilities and things that were happening around me. I was just flowing with the moment, basically. A lot of things happened. The economy changed a couple of times, and I think it was just an amazing amount of being in the right place at the right time and providing artwork that was really part of the moment. It really, I think, said something about what people were thinking back then and what their concerns were. And I was really lucky to be part of that.
And where were you living at that time?
I was living in the East Village.
In East Village.
Yeah.
And when did you get your loft in Soho?
Well, let's see. In 89, I needed another workspace. I had some rental studios. One of them was really large down in Tribeca that I rented. And that put me into the bad habit that I have now of needing tons of space, because I rented this gigantic loft on Walker Street.
You got spoiled.
I did. I was very spoiled. It was not a living space at all. But then I discovered that with the money that I was making at the time, that I could probably afford to combine the rents that I was paying at the apartment. We had an apartment on 9th Street and the studio to a mortgage payment was my idea. And Dina has a good mind for this kind of stuff, and she figured that we actually could do it, so we did. And we bought a loft on Crosby and Spring.
I know when I hear that, I just sigh with jealousy.
Oh, I know. But it was the most amazing thing to do.
Yeah, and at a time and place to be right in Soho at that moment, too.
Well, it was really funny, too, because Crosby Street was a dark, very unattractive street. Mm. On the side of Soho, it's on the other side of Broadway.
Right.
So it was not a place where a lot of people wanted to be. It was really a place where people didn't want to be. Mm. And we bought a first floor space also, which people didn't want. Mm. And it was dark and scary. Mm. But we loved it. Mm. And we had a great time there.
And you had your children there?
The children, Cleo and Kimberly, were born in the East Village. But we moved to that loft and they were 2 years old.
I see. So yes, you're raising kids.
2 year olds running around in Soho. Yeah.
My goodness. Good. Wow. So how did we transition, or how did you transition from doing your work, being set up in the East Village, having Gracie Mansion, getting some attention, Whitney Biennials, you're showing, you had some museum shows in there.
Oh, yeah.
But you go to Japan.
Oh, yeah.
And how did that happen?
Well, I feel like...
And when did you go to Japan?
By the time the 90s started up, I was having trouble selling my work. That's all there is to it.
Yeah, the market shifted.
The market had shifted. And I wasn't really a person who was going to sit around and whine about it. Mm-hmm. So I started playing around with computers. And I've had a friend who had just bought a Macintosh. Mm-hmm. And I thought it was the most amazing thing. I immediately started making drawings on it, which he immediately printed and which we immediately tried to sell. I don't know if we ever sold any of them, but I have a couple of them and they're really funny that we printed on his little... That little gray box.
That gray box.
When it came out.
The iMac.
And then I started, when the technology improved, I started making these interactive CD-ROM works. That was kind of a thing in the mid-90s. Ah. And I worked for this amazing company called Voyager. And they were a pioneer in interactive multimedia, which right now you might call the internet. Okay. But at the time, it had to be done on CD-ROMs because the internet was very exotic at that time. Mm-hmm. So I made a couple of those, and that's what got me into computers. Not only that, I'd also been working on some children's books. I was just looking for ways and things to do.
Right.
And that caught the eye. It's a longer story that I'm putting together here, but it caught the eye of Sony in Japan through an agent.
Okay.
And that's how I was asked to come over to Japan to do some illustration work at first.
And so you've developed a number of projects, but there's a Parappa the Rapper.
Yes.
And Thunder Bunny.
Yes.
Those are two of the kind of things you're kind of famous for, I guess, right?
Yes.
So did that happen at this point?
Yeah.
You go to Japan.
Yes.
Sonny's contacted you. They've invited you to come.
Yes.
And were you invited to stay and work or just to meet people and set up a relationship? How did that work?
I would come for about 2 weeks at a time. And I was coming about twice a year. Yeah. I would have meetings. They would tell me what they wanted me to do. I'd go back to New York, do it, then come back. The game that is really well known is Parappa the Rapper.
Okay.
And that was a Sony PlayStation game on the first incarnation of Sony PlayStation.
So did your friends, your existing artist friends, did they see what you were doing? Did they think, oh, what's this? This is cool. Or they're like, what the hell's going on? I
felt very little connection between the art world and what I was doing.
Uh-huh.
I was very into... It was a demanding job working on the game.
Right.
And we had two sequels. So from pretty much 1995 until 2001, I was working all the time on games and character designs and other things.
Did you like
Japan.
It?
I loved it.
Yeah?
I mean, the opportunity to go to Japan and to sit in... corporate offices in a tower in the middle of Tokyo with all these amazing talented designers, managers, people creating technology was amazing. Mm-hmm. What an experience. Mm-hmm.
I'll bet.
So great.
It was fascinating. Mm-hmm. So I want to ask you a question. I was thinking about a couple of things that I thought might be of interest to hear your responses to. Mm. Why do you think people collect things?
That's a good question. I collect a lot of things.
As do I. So, yeah, I know you do. So what is the attraction about being a collector?
Gosh, I have to think of my own experience. I'm kind of...
So as a kid, did you collect stuff? I mean, were you, other than art-related supplies and things like that?
I think... I mostly collected materials, which I still have a habit of doing.
Right.
But when I started, especially my real problem was when I started going to Japan, because there were so many amazing toys and objects. Oh, yeah. And I started buying a lot of toys. And I've always been interested in toys and brightly colored, shiny things. So there were a lot of those available in Japan. I started picking them up. And then they just filled up boxes. And it really actually wasn't a great thing to be doing, but it was fun.
Mm-hmm.
And I ended up with a lot of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And that actually will segue into another portion of our interview, I think.
Okay, good. Well, we can do that. Let me take a quick break and remind people that you're listening to the Tuesday Afternoon Show. I'm your host, Robert Tomlinson, in the studio with Rodney Greenblatt. You're listening to WGXC ACRA 90.7 FM, and thanks for joining us. Okay, so I know you have a huge space in Leeds, right?
Yes.
Where your studio is.
Yes.
But you have a building downtown on Main Street.
That's right.
You and Dean are refurbishing it.
Yes.
And there's a downstairs, what people might refer to as a retail space.
There are two.
There's two of them.
Yeah.
But one is going to be yours.
Yes.
And in that, you're going to create the Rodney Shop.
The Rodney Shop.
Okay. Tell us about what is that.
The Rodney Shop is going to look like a gift shop. And it's going to act like a gift shop. And it's going to be everything like a gift shop. But it's really going to be an artwork in itself. And I have been planning this for a while. It's always been kind of a dream, but retail in New York City is so expensive that it would be
impossible.
Impossible,
yeah,
basically.
Right.
But the building that Dean and I have purchased and are refurbishing has these two storefronts. One is occupied by a very nice dog food and dog accessories store, Perfect Tales of Catskill. And then the next shop happens to be empty. So that shop is going to be the Rodney Shop. And I'm planning to open in May.
Okay. So you're describing it looking, tasting, feeling like retail, but not retail. So how? So if you're sort of saying an art installation, but it sounds like it's not frozen. It's going to change, or is it?
Well, it's going to be dynamic. We were just talking about my collections. I have many collections of things. I'm going to sell those collections, as well as my artwork.
So it won't be just your original work. It'll be things that you've collected over the years that will be there.
Yes, things I've collected over the years.
My.
And
are you going to have an online version of this?
I've thought about that. I have on my website now. I have a web store,
right?
But I think I've always been attracted to the art gallery environment and also the retail environment. It's always been interesting to me. So I think I'm going to focus mostly on the retail environment instead of putting everything online. I think it's going to be more interesting and more fun. Mm-hmm. And I really want to be part of what's happening here on Main Street. And I'm really looking forward to that.
Do you have regular hours in mind?
Right now, I'm thinking of Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, maybe, as we get started.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll probably open at 11 in the morning and close in, you know, 6 or something like that. We're going to see how it goes.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Main Street, as you know, you've just had some guests talking about what's happening in Catskill, is transforming itself, and it's getting better. But we still have to be careful about how much time we spend and what we are doing there, because there aren't a lot of people sometimes in the middle of the week to make our retail spaces work. So we're going to have to experiment with that.
Right. Well, we're all looking forward to, of course, Hilo opening up, in April.
That's going to be fantastic.
That'll be a really wonderful time in the town.
And that's right across the street from the Rodney Shop.
I was going to say, it's right across the street. Mm-hmm. So I'm still trying to get a picture here. So inside, how many square feet do you have? It's about,
gosh, I don't know.
500?
Maybe.
Okay.
Under, I think.
Under 500.
Yeah.
So you're going to have things that you yourself make.
Yes.
And pieces of your collection over the years that you've acquired.
Yes.
And I've seen the store. I mean, it's going to be colorful.
Yes, it's already
bright and happy.
It's ready for the stuff.
It's
at this
ready
point.
For the stuff. And will there be things that are interactive?
I'm not thinking about. I it's a possibility, but for now, I'm going to start out with a lot of prints. I didn't explain that I also used to work for a gallery in Japan that was a print gallery, and they were in shopping malls, like a shopping mall print gallery, and we made a lot of prints. Some of them were framed, like packaged framed prints of cute characters doing cute things, mostly.
And this is things you designed.
I designed all the images, and they put together these different print products. So I'm going to sell those. I don't have that many of them, but I have enough to put a bunch of them up on the wall.
Mm-hmm.
And a whole bunch of other unframed prints, also from the same publisher.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll have lots of wall art that you could buy very inexpensively in the Rodney Shop.
Mm-hmm. That sounds wonderful.
Thank you.
So you have a recent book out?
I do have a book out.
Dharma Delight?
Dharma Delight.
Yeah. So we have a good 5 minutes left, but I want to make sure we get on this part of your life because I think it's a very important part. You are a meditator and you teach meditation.
That's right.
Right now, and I think you're doing a class for free at the Magpie.
That's right.
On Tuesdays at 10? Or
it's going to start at 9.
9 o'clock. Okay.
Yeah.
So what led you into meditation? Did that coincide with going to Japan or did it start before then?
I feel like I've basically had three careers. First as the fine artist and the second as an illustrator and designer in Japan. And then third as a Zen student, which I started about 10 years ago. Studying at the Village Zendo in New York City.
How did you get there? I mean,
I actually have had a lifelong interest in Zen from reading books, like when I was a teenager.
Uh-huh.
Like one of the famous books from the 70s is The Three Pillars of Zen.
Right.
I loved that book, but I had no idea what it meant or
right.
what anything
right.
in it was.
Right.
I just liked the stories and the whole idea of Zen.
Mm-hmm.
And that kind of just sort of jiggled around in my head for many years.
Mm-hmm.
In Japan, of course, as a tourist in Japan, I went to all kinds of temples.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's kind of a thing you do when you're in Japan and you're a tourist. You go to Kyoto and you go to all these temples. But I really wondered, what were these temples about? Who was that big guy, Buddha guy, sitting there? And why were people facing the wall and meditating? And who were the monks? And what was it all for?
Mm-hmm.
But I couldn't really get a good answer in Japan. It would be like here asking somebody, what is Christianity? It would be difficult for them to answer very simply.
Hmm.
And they would have a lot of feeling about it because depending on what denomination they grew up in or not, they might not really be willing to talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
It sort of seemed that way in Japan when I asked about Buddhism and Zen. So I came back to New York and I decided there must be a Zen temple in New York City. And there was many, actually.
So from that point, I mean, it's interesting to think about something intellectually and also have a memory bank, but yes. then to actually walk in.
Yeah.
Do you remember the first moment you walked in?
I was so surprised because all the temples that I'd been to in Japan were very Japanese looking
sure.
and very Buddhist looking.
Which but meant austere.
Austere. And if you've ever seen a Japanese temple in a book, it's
hard
to
describe. That's exactly what it looks like, huh?
But the Village Zendo looked more like a loft in Soho. White walls, sprinkler pipes, big windows on one end that you could see the East River. And I immediately felt at home because that's actually the environment that I was living in.
Mm-hmm.
And also right around the corner.
Right.
So I realized it was a place for me. And I started going, since I lived around the corner, I started going every morning.
How did you know how to start? Did you just pick a meditation class? Or what?
Well, they have beginning instruction every Monday. And they still do.
Mm-hmm.
Every Monday evening. So I went to the beginning instruction, figured out what to do. And then I just started going there every morning and putting in an hour of meditation every day.
How did it change your life?
I think at first, like many people, I wanted to solve some problems. I was very worried about different things. I had the kids growing up. I had a lot of stress, just the way everyone does.
Sure.
Financial worries and all kinds of things. And I thought maybe meditation might be able to help me in that area. And of course it did.
Mm-hmm.
But what I realized later was it's bigger than that. It's not just about your problems. It's about seeing the whole world as part of you. And I think meditation gives you the opportunity to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And when you start to see there's not a big connection between what's happening in you and what's happening in other people, you start to change.
Uh-huh.
You start to change your point of view. And I think that is so important.
Actually, I'm just feeling something here. If I share it with you, the way that you've articulated this, a lot of times when we feel anxious or we feel problems, we also feel kind of a self-imposed isolation.
Yes.
What you just mentioned was actually a way of belonging with everyone else with those feelings rather than opposed to those feelings.
Mm.
So you're realizing there's a path to an interconnectedness by realizing this isn't just my problem.
Mm-hmm.
It is an issue or a concern that many people share.
That's right.
So it's a way of belonging. And so obviously going to the Zendo, you had also other people who were there doing their own meditative practice.
Yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah. It's very interesting because we have of course, meditation is in silence and we don't talk mm-hmm. while we're there. Mm-hmm. But they do have like a talking practice on Sundays. Once a month, they have what they call a council. And we sit around in a circle and there's a topic. And everyone is allowed to talk one at a time with no crosstalk. So it would just be like people in a circle and one person just gets to say what they think about a subject. Mm. Like
kind of similar to a Quaker meeting house.
Very much. Yeah. Very much that model. And you really get to know the people in the group after a few sessions of that. And then we have a lot of activities at the Zendo. And one of the ways I became more involved was by programming, helping them program and actually produce events like music concerts, guest speakers, poetry readings, that mm-hmm. kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. So over the past 10 years, I've done a lot of that. In fact, I did so much of it that they eventually asked me to be the executive director of the Zendo.
Oh, my. Wow.
Which I was for 2 years.
My goodness.
And before I moved.
Yeah.
So I've had kind of a career with the Zendo
right.
of being a meditator and also administrator there. Right. And hopefully someday a teacher. I don't know about that. You have to wait and see, because the only way you can become a Zen teacher is if your teacher gives you the go-ahead. So I have to wait and see.
So we have about 25 seconds left.
Okay.
I want to make sure that I thank you for coming in, because it's been great to have you, and I hope it'll be the first of many experiences.
Yes.
Dharma Delights.
Yes.
So that you created Dharma Delights because you wanted to give people an introductory idea about meditation? Is
right.
that fair?
A lot of the illustrations came from work I did for the Zendo, and they went together to form this book.
Great. Well, it's a terrific read. I hope people have a chance to pick it up. And thank you again for joining us. And thank you for joining